Before we get started with the second set, just say you may have noticed that unlike our customary format, we don't have musicians tonight. This is not a statement we're making about musicians. We will include musicians at other readings, but we're working with different formats. When we have artists of this stature, we want there to be time for them to be heard and for you to hear one another and mix with one another and hang out a little bit. So we want to get started with the second set and hope that you will, those of you who can stay beyond 10, will hang around and just enjoy the wonderful Duff's ambiance, as they say. And I also want to tell you that River Styx will be sponsoring still another reading. This one will not be at Duff's, but will be at COCA, the Center for the Contemporary Arts, at 524 Trinity in University City. That reading will feature Stanley Elkin reading from his new book, The Rabbi of Lud, and along with Stanley Elkin, the Mid-American Dance Company will perform Elkin's work, Notes Toward a Eulogy of Joan Cohen. So that's Stanley Elkin reading from his new novel and reading with accompanying performance by the Mid-America Dance Company of another work. And that reading will be Sunday, October 18th at 7:30 at COCA, 524 Trinity in University City. Again, if you turn in your thing to get on the mailing list, or if you're on it already, you will get that further information on that in the mailing. Well, tonight's featured poet is not new to Duff's. He was reading here the first year of the series and has read periodically since, and it's always a pleasure and it's always something fresh that he lays on us. Donald Finkel is the author of 10 volumes of poetry, and they include The Garbage Wars, Adequate Earth, the dual volume Going Under and Endurance, and The Detachable Man. Over a more than 25-year period, Finkel's concerns have varied widely, ranging from subject matter that's domestic to subject matter that's quite exotic, from short poems to book-length narratives and collages. Whether he's writing about walking the dog, the cutting of trees down on his block, cave exploration, Antarctica, interspecial communication, his sympathies remain intensely human. His language fresh, humor intact. His most recent book, his 11th, is from Athenaeum and is a special one, Selected Shorter Poems, containing drawing on work which, over the span of Don's career, full of many, many terrific poems, a really work of substance that reflects the many facets of his poetic originality. He is the poet in residence of Washington University, has helped many, many writers over the years in this area and around the country. And it's always great to welcome back to Duff's Don Finkel.
Does that sound like a right angle? Or is that more like a 45-degree angle, which, can you all hear me? Good. I realize that whereas prophets are without honor in their own country, poets are, I guess, without shame, especially if they've read before. Because if they assume that you were interested in hearing what they had to say once, you may have to hear it again, especially since I'll be reading from the selected shorter poems to some extent, since it's the easiest thing to carry around. That means that some of you may have heard some of this before, for which I ask some forgiveness. I'll try to make it as painless as possible. One of the reasons I did want to read from it, though, was not in order to hawk the book, but it gave me a chance to read some things that you might not have read, and I tried very hard not to read the ones before I came here so that they would be surprises to me, too. I thought I'd start out by reading some early poems that were as far away from me as possible. So if I make any mistakes, it's because I haven't read them in 20 years. This one is a perfect way to begin, I see now that I see the title. It's called Of All the Ways to Die. I didn't mean to start with that. Once I realized what I'd done, I can't stop. Ridiculous Midas broke his teeth on gold, and the old fool repented. The little princess resented the pea. Then they knew her. Folks in the old days made a regular profession of displeasure. Castles were drafty arrangements, musty old tombs at best. Banging lances under the azure brought blue bruises, and later the fair lady gave out her favors to the aching victor from an icy bed. Ridiculous Midas beat his body against his gold sheets. The little princess tossed all night on the pea. Of all the ways to die, to croak in a drafty castle is the best. Death seems to be a mild obsession in this case, because I see that the next poem I had in mind is a kind of meek little elegy. I was intimidated by the idea of writing poems about anything so serious as death back then. As I get closer to it, I might be willing to try a little less meekly. But this is all I could do at the time. It's called Ingratitude. Small but adequate deaths try me at every turn. What I do not kill myself dies while I look on. The swallow I picked up under his nest this morning, I tried to feed all day with the dropper, but tonight he died. And how many times has a fly kicking the death from his belly pained me an instant till I hit him more squarely. And I am loath to remember a lizard I kept in a can that cooked while I dawdled at dinner in the afternoon sun. Who mocked me with the nestling and kept him alive all day, nodding his head at something I could not see? Shall I let him know of my grief regarding the housewives, seeing what hurt me was not their death, but merely their dying? No matter, all things considered, I thank whoever was kind, at least for the death of the lizard, while my back was turned. From death to something a little more deadly, this is a poem called Marriage. this one you continue to experience. It's based on an image which I was beginning to believe within a few years after I wrote it that I never saw, but I think I saw once in a movie such an image as the one I'm going to use as the metaphor for this poem. The arrangement is essentially comic, silent, and familiar to the audience. You walk, and then I, 6 feet behind. We are carrying something between us, not visible, but obvious enough. We are careful, though not beyond reason. We do this every day. The audience knows what to expect. The hero comes intent on his labors, of which we have no part. Whatever he is doing, we are only here to make things difficult, that is, to go on doing what we are doing, being careful, but not beyond reason. You pass, always the gentleman, he waits. Between you and me, The distance is endless. The audience catches its breath. Now, flattened against the glass, his handsome, empty face registers the first flicker of surprise. I pass. He will continue his labors. He will return presently, bearing for the heroine a cluster of wilted flowers. We go on. The audience no longer notices that we continue to bear between us something invisible, difficult to manage, fragile, and slightly besmeared. By popular request, that is, one person asked for this. I will read a poem that's called A Poem and a Prayer to St. Hofstein. The only thing I can tell you about this is that it is entirely literally true, though I'm sure you won't believe that. St. H. was born at the age of 33 to an elderly candy store in the West Bronx. He set up shop at once in a room in the back. One iron cot, a box of books, and Madame Blavatsky. The iron-faced virgin glared on his every breath from the lintel with a thumbtack in her forehead. St. H. endured terrible migraine headaches. So passed his childhood. At the age of 33, looking 12 years older, blinking behind his glasses his brown, good-natured eyes of an intelligent cocker spaniel, St. H. stepped out of his shell into the sunlight. An angular second-hand bookstore from Queens played stoop ball with a runny-nosed kid brother. The scene was etched in sunlight. The dust glittered. St. H. performed several middle-aged miracles. He buried a half dollar at the foot of a ginkgo in front of his mother's. The next day, dug up a dime. He ate no meat, saying, "A man is what he eats. I am a vegetable." He drank water as if it were wine. He made old women smile. For weeks on end, he lived on absolutely nothing but an occasional slice of love on a dry bagel, simply because he forgot. He wrote a book on the squaring of the circle, proposing therein a new geometry. Theorem 1, a line is beautiful. He lectured on dreams at the Lonely Hearts Club social. All day Sunday, he stood in front of the Museum of Natural History, waiting for Martians. "They walk among us," he said when we were assembled. "They wear our clothes and our faces and speak our language." Somebody asked the obvious. He said, "They will recognize me." St. H., patron of all those who are born middle-aged with a PhD in astrology, of all those the Martians have forgotten, St. H. of the Lonely Heart, St. H. of the Square, St. H. of Queens, shrine in back of the bookstore. She has gone blousy. The children all have colds, a constant haggle over the vegetables. "Gentle spaniel, I lift your homely image with outstretched hands. I drive from this room the demons of pride and impatience. St. H., may I be 33 forever like you." I'd like to read a couple of poems at this point from a volume called What Manner of Beast, which is the one Mike mentioned that dealt with interspecies communication. In it, I explored the possibilities of communicating with various beasts, from chimpanzees to stones. This one is called Of Course and deals with, I guess, about five beasts. the first one we meet is, in a sense maybe, the first one we meet is Sarah, a chimpanzee who learned to communicate by placing magnetic symbols on a board in sentences. Then there's Walnut, a chimpanzee who was introduced to her when it became obvious that she was getting horny. He was a little too young for it, but what can you do? That was the best they could find. Then there was Lucy, who learned to communicate by using her hands and spoke in Amislan, the American Sign Language. Then there was a goose, who apparently has no name, at least not in this poem. And finally, there is David Premack, the most peculiar beast of all. And you can tell that by what he says, which I've incorporated into the poem. The poem, again, is called Of Course, and begins with a quotation from David Premack concerning the changes he observed taking place in Sarah, which he somehow had forgotten to calculate on. That is, she was coming into womanhood. By the time of her fourth cycle, however, she twice attacked her previously favored trainers. The actual causes of these attacks are unknown, of course. When Sarah came into her fullness, she had been 7 years from home, laboring in the rational vineyard, having not once laid eyes in all that time on a male of her own persuasion, till Walnut, bright, obliging Walnut, came. She reached through the bars and, clutching him close, took his unfledged Peter in her mouth, scrotum and all, whereupon the trainer whipped out his clipboard and his flare. For a brief period, Walnut was used as a contingent event. On a board outside her cage, we wrote such things as, Sarah is good if then Mary gives Sarah Walnut, and the more explicit, Sarah insert cracker red dish if then Mary gives Sarah Walnut. Instructions of this kind restored Sarah's work habit. You can see which are the most peculiar kinds of beasts I discovered in this whole book. There are, of course, alternatives. Take Lucy, who married a vacuum cleaner. When her labia bloomed like some carnivorous flower, she dropped her magazine and plugged him in, ran his gleaming nozzle over her body, switching from suck to blow, until she had what I inferred to be an orgasm. She laughed, looked happy, and stopped suddenly. She then turned off the machine, picked up her unfinished glass of gin and her magazine. Or take the goose who courted the garbage can. 3 furious years he defended his mate from the garbage men and danced the triumph dance under her vacant, battered gaze, mounted her in season, his wings, his heart aflutter. He would never react to greylag calls or even to females, but if you just rattle a piece of metal, he would immediately act as if there were another greylag calling him in the distance. When they carried his lady off for keeps, he watched them flatten her in the crusher, heard her death rattle, then followed the garbage hearse, of course, 2 blocks through the deafening traffic till he was crushed himself. That is all literally the case, and chilling. This is another kind of beast entirely. This is a meeting between 2 kinds of beasts. It regards the earliest meetings of the Europeans and the Eskimos, the Canadian Eskimos, the Arctic Eskimos, in the 16th century by Sir Martin Frobisher and his crew. I don't think it needs much explanation, except perhaps that the word kabluna, which one of the Eskimos uses, simply is their word for the white man. The poem is called Another Matter, and like the other poem, is interlarded with odd bestial sayings by Frobisher. From his account of his second voyage. What knowledge they have of God, or what idol they adore, we have no perfect intelligence. I think them rather anthropophagi, or devourers of man's flesh, than otherwise, for that there is no flesh or fish which they find dead, smell it ever so filthily, but they will eat it. From the first encounter, all escaped but one, huddled in the forestays, scowling like a Tartar in his bloody skins. Now, from the last transaction, this old witch, lost in her furs like a withered root, when the men first flung her to the deck, they tore her moccasins off to see if her feet were cloven. Very strange and beastly, maggots nuzzling the salmon, seal guts spread on a stone to dry. Bleeding from a scalp wound, the younger female croons over an injured girl child, barely two, hugging to her meager breast one arm like a bloody doll. Our surgeon, meaning to heal her child's arm, applied salves thereunto. But she, not acquainted with such kind of surgery, plucked those salves away, and by continual licking with her own tongue, not much unlike our dogs, healed up the child's arm. Strange, strange, exceedingly strange, the mother's cheek tattooed in broad blue strokes, her lank locks glistening with blood. The man savage, formally taken, and she brought together, every man with silence desired to behold the manner of their meeting, which was more worth the beholding than can be well expressed. A good space they beheld, each one the other, speechlessly, as if the grief of captivity had riven their tongues. Then the young female turned her face to the wall, and crooning, soft as a wounded dove, began to sing, as though she minded another matter. Ice mother, your light smiles from the snow crust, winks at the sun. He trudges past you, brushing your hummocks with his red knuckles. Ice mother, mighty stillness, we drowse on your breast the long night. Through the skin of your cold blue eye, we fish for our dinner. But being again brought together, the man broke up the silence first, and with a stern and staid countenance, began to tell a long, solemn tale. Beside me, one brute fell, an arrow through the spleen, while of the people, three died on the beach. Yet strove while their arrows lasted, then gathered Kabluna's arrows, then snatched the arrows from their wounds and let those fly. And I saw from the bow of this demon canoe an old man bleeding leap from the cliff. And another I saw, then another, that they should not be taken, leap, while the rest escaped. Whereunto she gave good hearing, and interrupted him nothing till he had finished, and afterwards, being grown into more familiar acquaintance by speech, they were turned together, and together, and together, each rarely out of the other's sight, as if they could not bear to be alone. Yet never were they seen in all that time to use as man and wife, though she made his bed and dressed his meat, though she nursed him through his final illness, scrupulous as any Christian, she bathed him, crooning, her eyes turned to the wall, as though she minded another matter. More or less, I guess, at this point, an expression of my state of mind as I get toward the end of the book. I'll then go back and go through it again. Don't worry. This is a poem called Concerning the Transmission. Any of you who have tried to nurse cars through long illnesses will know about this. Concerning the Transmission. You might say the same of poetry. You've sunk too much in it to quit now, driving good hours after bad, too much of you wound round the wires and the hoses. You might stop addressing this absence beside you, cursing through the intricate cities, singing in the high passes, tooling down freeways, minding the numbers, ears pricked for oracular tappings, limping past fields of sullen junkers, eye holes crawling with nettle and goldenrod. If you let go now, the bearings will scream from their orbits, the rocker arms clang in their cylinders, and the needles return to their various zeros, as if your hands had never clenched this sweaty wheel. That's a complaining poem. This is a straight paranoid poem. This regards one of the people who have not yet organized themselves, but are a serious minority, the left-handed. It's called the Left-Handed Juggler, and attacks the very basis of our language, just as the blacks and feminists have done. The left-handed juggler has everything it takes to reel in those steak knives wickering past his ears, except dexterity. Rectitude, he mutters. Righteousness, by rights, kingdoms, teetering on the point of a word, sharp as a scream, self-evident as a splinter under a thumbnail. He lets the fearful helix snicker on. How can he be right in the head out there, risking his earlobes and his life? And for what? For three squares and a flop? Right now, for once, he'd set things left. But the terrible cutlery of circumstance whirls counterclockwise round the right of way, caressing his sinister fingers. You watch out for anybody who has his left hand still hiding behind his back. This one is more or less also a kind of complaint against certain usages in language. I've always been disturbed by the way that people who write advertising nowadays describe trousers as a new and lovely pant. Something bothers me about that. I keep seeing a woman walking around with only one, which is sort of intriguing, but never happens that way. They always end up with two pants. This poem is called The Tenth Mew. She's come up today with an all-new, all-weather pant. Cross-legged on the clock computer radio, she's trimming the slack from my vocabulary. She's, clipping my baggy syntax down to the quick. She'd like me to try on her all-purpose washable pro. Fits like a second skin, better than the first, and irresistible to the opposite sex. Stunning, serviceable, guaranteed till I die, and after, she swears, I'll make a handsome corpse. No hard feeling, I reply, old Mew. This time, no thank. I glimp on her face the first faint glimmer of surprise. When I was a lad, one of the requirements of any young poet was that he write at least one poem about Orpheus and one poem about some other damn myth. I thought I would read you some rather odd poems dealing with myths, not quite always as impressive as Orpheus. The first one is a poem called, pardon my French, it's always very poor, the pronunciation is bad, Le Jongleur de Notre Dame, The Juggler of Our Lady. I am going to tell you the story, but essentially it's about a juggler who, it refers to a juggler who found his way to a monastery and found that there was not much that he could offer at the Feast of Our Lady but his own juggling, while everybody else was making sculptures, writing sermons, and so on. So he started practicing juggling in front of the statue of Our Lady until the monks found him and tried to stop him. The lady came down from the altar and wiped the sweat off his brow with her blue robe. Le Jongleur de Notre Dame. It runs something like this. This is certainly not the age for tragic figures, since whoever heard of a tragic figure getting a majority in the popular elections? I didn't say pathetic, you understand. Secondly, everybody is hip these days. Who is dumb enough to get himself killed for a cause? Or the little fellow kicking 6 copper balls and 12 knives with his heels before the Mother of God? The sweat gathers on his brow. However, he does not wish to appear ridiculous. His hands are free at all times with a handkerchief, should the lady prefer to remain on the altar. The next one is more recognizable, I think, and needs no description or retelling. It's called Rumpelstiltskin. It is not possible to spin gold out of straw. You know that. I know that. But it was not so in the old days. Then people were slave to a strange, benevolent darkness. They thought overnight peasant girls could be turned into princesses. The king thought so. The miller thought so. Even the miller's daughter thought so. She thought it was merely impossible for her. Only Rumpelstiltskin knew better. He knew, however, that every morning when the sun struck through the window just so, the straw became gold as any gold. It is always given to men with ridiculous names to keep worthless secrets like that in a land of fools. It was this secret the new queen finally discovered, and not his name, which he did not utter simply because it embarrassed him. Once the truth was out, however, and it was clear that anybody could turn the trick, the queen began to mock him with his name. Rumpelstiltskin, Rumpelstiltskin, she giggled. Rumpelstiltskin. I don't know that the next character needs too much introduction either. Lilith was actually the first woman and the first wife of Adam, not Eve, but she was a rather questionable sort and finally had to be banished and forgotten. I've remembered her here. This poem is called Lilith. She hissed in my ear, "What can you lose?" She wasn't bad, but for the nose, that battle axe, long, loose, black hair, black, arrogant eyes, generous mouth, great, creamy boobs on the frame of a boy. She laid for dwarves and garbage men, fucked like a snake, beak like a hawk, held open house in her round bed, without a foot, without a head. Where is she now, slithering across what littered moonscape, stirring with that irreverent snoot the dreams of virgins, dry, gritty snatches of spinsters, night lizard, demon of lonely sleepers, while we tumble and turn in our four-square bed, between us a field, a flock, a house, two grumbling boys, 20 years of sweat and bread, and everything to lose. Those two grumbling boys are Cain and Abel, not mine. I only have one. One last one that's more recent than that, and then we'll have it with the myth biz. This one is called The Kindly Ones. I was fascinated to discover that the people we ordinarily think of as extremely terrifying were characterized by the Greeks as the kindly ones, in order, the Eumenides, that is to say, rather than the Furies, because they didn't want to antagonize them. It's always better not to antagonize people with strong views. And the views of the Eumenides or Furies were extreme righteousness toward people who had trespassed. It starts with a quote from Aeschylus' Libation Bearers. "They're real enough to me. Can you not see them? Hounds of a mother's curse? The kindly ones. Streaming from Erebus through a crack in the pavement, they crowd the door of the abortion clinic. Older than Zeus, in Ilium every beggar had one to keep him groveling. Under their lavender pantsuits, bat wings, coal black breasts and leathery shanks, in their turquoise purses, thorny scourges to harry the murderesses sidling to slaughter. Among us as ever, they hound the infanticides past the threshold of shadows, brandishing raspberry smiles and saccharine piety, counseling poverty, chastity, a term of virtuous labor, then years of sackcloth and vain remorse." One of my other, it's not a matter of obsession so much, it's a matter of helplessness in this case. We spend a lot of time and have spent a lot of time in Mexico. I promised myself at first that I would not write poems about Mexico because I hated travel poems, exotica, and so on, what I used to call my Guggenheim on the Spanish Steps. But after a while, if you live in a place long enough, it gets to you. So I wanted to read three or four of those. Here's one which characterizes the position we find ourselves in Mexico, though I guess since this time I've learned a little more Spanish. The stranger. On a bench in the plaza, under the barbarous trees, I chew my thumb and watch the girls go round one way, the boys the other, a stranger in a town of strangers. In the market, a man is selling his hands. They hang from his shirt like shameful meat. Between us, this uneasy peace. If he won't look in my pocket, I won't stare at his sleeves. The label in my shirt says, "Do not maltreat me." I should paint it on my hat. And what are the children crying? The consonants spill from their tongues like streams of colored pebbles. The names of their vowels are warbler, linnet, nightingale, and dove. Here at last, I can say what I mean without fear of being understood. And one of the things that also fairly characteristically disturbs Americans coming to Mexico, because they can avoid looking at it in their own cities, the beggars. This poem is called Alms. His knees drawn up to let me pass, he is small and miserable as any man. His stick lies meek at his side. If he speaks, it will rise and strike at the walk. Pity will drool from the paving stones. He rattles a cupful of furious pencils, each one sharpened to its point. He holds out his fabulous sockets for me to fill with silver. Raptly my right good hand, like an enchanted eel, glides through my pocket. Sweetness blooms in my heart and dies, a rose of blood. And for an instant, I have more than I need. A couple that are a little newer than that. One, in fact, just from this last summer, and probably better not to read, but what the hell. It's called Masks and is in two parts. One. Do you play the piano, Signora? Artemio asks as he waits to be paid. He inclines toward the baby grand, not merely his head, but his shoulders as well. Once long ago, I knew a girl who played. His face is a mask hacked by a dull machete. The mouth is crooked and too small, the nose amorphous, the eyes bored with an auger and set with crumbs of obsidian. Whoever carved him from whatever stump was thinking of something else at the time. Though his arms are of a length almost, on his left hand the clumsy blade bit down and sheared off the last three fingers, leaving the thumb and forefinger stiffly opposed, ill-starred lovers doomed never to part from one another, nor unite. Despite this, or because of it, who knows, deep in his heartwood, Artemio hides the soul of an artist. Holding his truncated hand erect like a portable anvil, the shapes he fashions from blanks of brass are scrupulous, functional, and slim as a grasshopper's mandible. One lies in the Signora's hand, a shining icon. It will guard her house from harm or conjure it open again. As the Signora weaves an etude on a warp of steel, Artemio perches on a chair like a carven idol. Behind the hole in his mask, something smiles. Tiny crumbs of brass gild his shoes in the last rays of the afternoon sun. Two. The baby's dying. The old agreeable smile as she strides with the almost customary stride to see the man about the ashes, but not quite. Any moment the ligatures that lift the corners of her mouth and eyes, the invisible strings that twitch her down the street, will part. Some say a smile is an arrested snarl, a kind of white flag, a way of saying, you win, enough. After millennia, however, we've learned how not to show any teeth, how to wear our smiles like masks all day and half the night, how to ask through the aperture, how are you? how to carol the babies dying in the old contralto. The scorpions laid her eggs on the threshold. All night the baby howls. His skull is naked, cobbled with obscene cysts. Not a hint of eyebrow, not a single lash, just a mask of all but permanent anguish. Not quite. Luckily, Uncle, enough. A group of poems, four of them, that are about another obsession of mine, and that is painting and aesthetics. Certain aspects of it have always fascinated me and puzzled me, and I didn't realize it, but I began to look and began to discover that not only had I written about it this summer, and I'll read that one last, but I had written about it several times before. This one is called Still Life. The truth is, a man has to go out of his way to choose three apples, a cup, and a butter knife for company at the bottom of love's ladder. It would have been so much more soothing to think as long as one began with illusion in any case, that he might as well live out his novitiate watching some wench offer between two fingers the strawberry of her breast. Or how moral one felt, lifting again that limp form down from the tree, whose death was so much less dead than these impersonal groceries motionless on the table. These apples will neither save nor curse. Their only virtues are that they can be bought, are edible till they rot, and will inform you, if you choose to attend, that the world you move in is round, palatable, composed, and incorrigibly itself. This one deals with something I find a lot more puzzling. I discovered that the painter Raphael had said, and was famous for having said, "My painting will never offend." That seemed like an odd kind of ambition, to me anyway, as he naturally tries to offend at every corner. The way Beatrice does not offend, perhaps. She chides you for your own good. The way Circe does not offend, it is the smell of the other pigs that assails your nostrils. However, there is always the danger of replacing the beau ideal with the least common denominator, the true Rheingold girl, so inoffensive as to be completely invisible, odorless, a virgin. No martyrdoms, no last judgments, and after one or two youthful indiscretions, no crucifixions either. He who had seen the streets splash in the blood of Grifone's victims and then in Crivoni's, preoccupied with the harmony of gestures. Not to offend Jesus is one thing, not to offend Judas another. Judas has paid for his good manners with a sensitive stomach. Everything offends him. Something simple, please. Chopped steak and a baked potato. Jesus, on the other hand, has a stomach like a boiler. Where he hangs, nothing can offend him but himself. Yet, if we could smell her out, that lady of silences, who can lead men at her whim to heaven or hell, resigned to be saints or satisfied to be swine, she would bring a peace like the Son of God, not in his aspect of Florence Nightingale, nor either wearing Marx's whiskers over his goatee, but as that god of women, Dionysus, wearing nothing but an archaic smile and, over his article, a cluster of purple nipples. I hope I offended Raphael, wherever he is. Two last ones that are more recent. That's sort of interesting. I haven't killed it completely. One of them is does have an epigraph, a short one that has an epigraph. It's called This Year, and begins with an epigraph that I found in the New Yorker down there that I discovered. National Paint has developed anti-graffiti clear coat, which forms a sort of varnish on the surface of a building and allows writing to be cleaned off with solvent. At National, business is brisk this year. Before those walls, rude glyphs on cliff sides, meanders by the mouths of caves, icons incised on standing slabs, the rain erases grain by grain. Lopsided hearts nailed to the bark of trees the wolves will soon reclaim. Now everywhere on lampposts and urinals, scribbled, scrawled with laborious magic markers, day glow spray cans, they leave their tokens, their signatures, their signs and countersigns, their barbaric slogans, even on the sky. And though their names are purged with water, scoured by wind, even as I write, their sons are learning in six-floor walk-up caves to carve their savage runes with knives of flame. The last one is a four-part poem entitled, and this is it, I give up. And it's just about the last thing I wrote, and probably, again, unfortunate to read at this point, but I like it. Still, it won't be long. It's called Four Portraits of the Artist as an Old Man. One, an Aphrodite for Alberti. To brighten the irises of the young marinero, barely 66, Picasso's erstwhile exile in arms, Alberti, beached now two oceans away, he runs the tip of his brush along the Willendorfian rondure of her breasts. They rise below her upheld arms like beatified moons as she draws her fingers through her seaweed hair. Now his moist brush plunges down the sheer Minoan waist until, wafted on thermals, it caresses the eloquent haunches, twiddles the starfish nipples in the grip of this incorrigible 87-year-old satyr, strokes in passing, like an afterthought, the tiny equivocal face, then mutters farewell beneath one spectacular satellite, Su amigo Picasso, 8/11/68. This one, which is called Victory Boogie Woogie, has an epigraph from Werner Spies, a book that I found that one of our renters, a poet himself, W.D. Snodgrass, left and I think hadn't read. It was full of wonderful goodies. This is one of them. Mondrian is said, as he grew old, to have invariably sat with his back to the window because the sight of trees filled him with revulsion. Snodgrass, weep your heart out. You missed it. 72 years tilting at the windmills of the actual. 72 years keeping chaos at bay, reclaiming artifice by inches from the encroaching sea. 72 years promising an earthly paradise. If only our intentions are good enough, it should not prove impossible. Trees true as plumb lines, a dancer naked, latent, proud as a tire, as a tower, an odalisque serene as the low, unbroken Dutch horizon, outstretched like a seamless levee, not to mention a couple of desperately ideal cityscapes besotted with Broadway, where the mathematical artistic temperament of the future should be rendered incarnate. And still at his back through the window, something was silently writhing, fluttering, plunging. Soon enough, he'd be a flat one himself. And the year after that, how could he imagine the mathematicians would demonstrate the dead on the level logic of E equals MC squared over Hiroshima? Three is Duchamp descending staircase. The delightful thing to realize is that was the last painting he made, the one that everybody knows and is considered to be the most famous. He figured he'd had it then, and from then on he did all kinds of wonderful insults. But not another piece of what the bourgeoisie would call art. Midwinter, midnight, striding into the wind across Union Square, between the naked, ungainly trees, he conjures behind gray facades battalions of benighted wheels turning wearily on their stools. If only he could cease this restless descent, the stairs would bear him miraculously backwards like an escalator, sliding between the glossy pages off 1,000 coffee tables. Yet he persists, an idea who's long outlived his time, an androgynous Alice avalanching down his private rabbit hole to stay in place, swimming against the torrent of the ready-made, struggling to leave no wake. It's what he has instead of hope. Already his fountain, which was a urinal turned upside down, is creeping down the museum stairs to stand on her head in the gentleman's lavatory. Already his faultless marble sugar cubes are tumbling into the Delft blue bowls of the bourgeoisie. He's been preparing now for 20 years, the interpreted man whose every step and gesture must have held, one thought, some message, assembling even as he turns westward along 14th the elements of one valedictory scream of the peacock, his given. Twin peepholes in a wooden door through which one voyeur at a time can peer at the beaver of the lady with the gas lamp, utterly fallen, asprawl on the shore of a picture postcard lake, set off by authentic twigs in a waterfall. That's actually his last great work. Finally, figure and ground, with a quotation from Matisse, from the last kinds of things he did, I draw with scissors. If any of you saw the show quite a few years ago at the Art Museum, which we were lucky to have, you see how lovely those were. His last, the last house in which he lived in France was called La Rêve, the dream. A snapshot of the master in bed at La Rêve, near the end of the book, though there are still a few last pages. He's working on one right now. A shape is coming free from the square in his hand, from time, fatigue, death, from the wounded body of France, Europe, Earth, the universe. The wall behind him is hung to the ceiling with enchanted beasts, with nudes like flowers, with stars like birds, with a white hole all but filled by a black balloon on which a paper acrobat is balanced, with two ferns tending a paper fire like priests at a sacrifice. Yet never so drenched is he in the emergent shape that he has forgotten the shape of what remains, of vacancy, loss, indifference. The ruminations of the toothless pensioner gumming his midday gruel, disconsolate, pinned to the dingy, drawn-down shade. Or the crimson glint on the captain's cigarette as it glides toward his prisoner's raw sienna nipple. Or the incandescence of his pleasure, or the cool, compassionate darkness into which she descends, or the iridescent laughter in the kitchen yard where the garbage men are heaving onto their truck bed dove-gray cinders blazoned with tangerine rind, the multicolored leavings of La Reve. Nor so attentive has he grown to these paper phrases that he has forgotten the tongue from which they were paired, or the shape of what is left unsaid, not only the scrap of truth, but the vast ignorance from which it springs, nor grown so giddy waltzing with those delectable sisters, figure and ground, that he has forgotten those edges cutting their way through the uncomplaining paper. Thank you.
Thank you to Donald Finkel and Richard Russo, our readers this evening. And thank you for coming. We hope to see you at one of the or both of the River Styx programs next month. River Styx PM, October 18th, Sunday, 7:30, Center of Contemporary Arts in University City at 524 Trinity, Stanley Elkin reading from a new novel and from a work for performance with the Mid-America Dance Company, Sunday, October 18th, and October 19th at Duff's, Verda Mae Grosvenor, Sterling Plump, and the musicians George Sams and Floyd LaFleur. Hope to see you soon.